This is AutoLine After Hours, unscripted, uncensored, unapproved. Are you a podcast kind of person? Then look for AutoLine After Hours wherever you go for your favorite podcast.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, solutions for your journey, and by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, Gary.
John, I was going to ask you how you are, but I can see you're feeling better because you're in the studio and you're not broadcasting from your house.
No, that's exactly right. You know, I still haven't fully kicked this thing, but I'm giving COVID the finger and just ignoring it.
There you go.
The hell with COVID.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad you're back and feeling better-ish.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Hey, we got a great show today. I can't wait to get into this. Maybe we should just bring in the other guys. There's Sam Abielsamid and Bob Purcell. Sam, always great to have you back on the show.
It's good to be back with you again.
Yeah. And Bob, it's great to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you, John. It's a real pleasure to be here with you and the team. Excellent.
Look, we got a great chance to talk all things electric. I mean, your involvement in electric, it goes what? Back 20 years ago, right? Before anybody even thought of a Tesla, you were already involved in
20,
electric.
I think it would be 30, no, Bob?
Yeah, it's about 30. I started in electric in 94.
Wow.
When I took over the electric vehicle programs in General Motors.
Yeah, now, what was that the S10 pickup at that time, or what was going on?
No, that was the EV1. I mean, these are the vehicles that I worked on back in that time frame. You know, the 96 EV1. You're right about the pickup truck. That was the old S10 electric in 97. And really, John, the car that I was most proud of in that era was the one we did for the 1999 Tokyo Motor Show. And it was called the Chevy Triax. It was a concept car that debuted, actually, the whole idea of an electric skateboard.
See, now that's amazing, because here all along, you know, the whole industry has given credit to the GM Autonomy, which was a brilliant car too, right, with the integrated fuel cell and all that. Everyone cites that as the first skateboard, but you're saying the Triax came out before that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we were the first ones. This was, a vehicle where we had multiple propulsion options in the skateboard. So you could have an electric skateboard, an internal combustion skateboard, or a hybrid skateboard. So the customer could actually select which propulsion was most appropriate for, you know, for their usage. It was actually slated to be the second generation of the EV1. I mean, this was, at the time, a 2002 General Motors production program.
Can you imagine if GM had gone through with that at that time, Bob, where it'd be today?
Well, I'll tell you, the guy who commented on it, and you can see his quotes, is Elon Musk. Elon Musk, you know, knew about what we were doing with Triax. And he said if General Motors would have kept going with the next generation of the EV1, he probably never would have done Tesla.
Wow. So talk about this skateboard. I mean, you know, who
John, I think we ought to go before the skateboard and then get to the skateboard. Because,
sure,
I mean, I think what Bob did at General Motors should not go unheralded in his work. And so one of our colleagues, Gary Witzenberg, had written a story about the EV1, and I want to quote from that. And it says, and I quote, "Purcell began restaffing our group," because Gary worked on the development of the EV1, "began restaffing our group and elevated it to divisional status as GM Advanced Technology Vehicles Division. Quote, there were two fundamental challenges," Purcell later said, "technical feasibility, can you make it work, and commercial viability, can you make it at a cost that people can afford and shareholders can get a return on their investments?" So, Bob, you were the guy who basically kickstarted officially General Motors Advanced Technology Vehicles.
Yeah, that was my group for almost 10 years, and we were doing, you know, all the new technology in GM. Completing development and then taking them into low volume production. So I had the electrics, the early hybrids, the alternative fuels. For a while, I even had the GM military vehicles in that group. But it was the last fully integrated division of General Motors. I was not matrixed you know, it was we had our own plant, the Lansing Craft Center, you know, where the old Riata was built. You know, we had probably one of the most talented groups of engineers and business people ever in the industry. I still remember over the build area in the project center, we had a banner that said "Making Automotive History Together," because I said, we know this car is going to be in the history books. It's depending how we perform will determine how people will write about it.
Bob, I got to ask you, did you work with Paul McCready? Because, you know, the EV1, as you know, I'm saying this for the audience's benefit, that done started out as the Impact done by AeroVironment. And I've described, you know, Paul McCready started AeroVironment. I've described him as the American Da Vinci. It's like that guy could do anything.
Yeah, no, AeroVironment was heavily involved in that first generation car, which was actually shown in 1990 at the LA Auto Show by Roger Smith. And it, you know, a lot of people said that General Motors did the EV1 as a reaction to the ZEV mandate. No, General Motors caused the ZEV mandate in California with the EV1. Once the California regulators saw that someone could do this, they said, well, everyone should do that. But that car, you know, that's what I inherited, was the project car. We had done a test drive program called Preview, and we had 50 vehicles that we built and took them around and gave them the customers to drive for a week. It wasn't like you were doing a drive around the parking lot. All the vehicles were outfitted with ProDAS data recorders. So we were accumulating real technical data off the cars as customers were using them in their real life driving experience. So a customer would say, car felt like it lost power. We could go back and actually know what was happening technically on the vehicle at the time that comment was made. And it was a really great learning experience. But from that concept car to production, we changed 80% of the parts on the car.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And then there was no supply base, right? The early ones were hand built. So we had to create a supply base. Now, at that time, GM still had Delphi. So we were able to, you know, leverage the Delphi capability.
Hey, why'd you have to change so many parts?
They weren't manufacturable.
Oh,
That's a good reason. Gary would appreciate that comment.
I actually worked at Delco Moraine. Before it was Delphi, it was all, you know, the various Delco divisions. I was working at Delco Moraine NDH at the Milford Proving Grounds in 1990 and 91. It was my first job after I graduated from GMI and working on ABS. And I remember during that time, some of my colleagues were developing a version. It was a modification of the ABS-6 ABS system that they wanted to use for rear electric brakes. And they had a couple of Geostorm mules that they had built up that they were testing electric rear brakes. So get rid of the hydraulics at least on the rear axle, and using a modified version of the ABS-6 hydraulic unit to do the brake applications on the rear wheels in concert with what the driver was applying on the brake pedal.
Wow. Well, some of the most sophisticated technology on the EV1 was the blended regenerative brake system, right? Where we had to make it feel, you know, seamless to the driver so that there was no interruption. It was, the coast down was very normal, if you will. But that was some of the most sophisticated technology in the vehicle. And on ABS, you know, we created the idea of using the ABS system for tire pressure monitoring because you'd measure differential wheel speed. Okay. And so you didn't have to put any other hardware on the car. You just used the sensing system that was in the ABS.
See, that's amazing to hear. I thought Toyota was the first to do it on a mass production car. But I didn't know that you guys had pioneered that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, John, truth of the matter is, and I won't get into the specifics, General Motors actually licensed some technology to Toyota back in that era.
Well, and the whole concept of the parallel hybrid, the power split hybrid system that became the Toyota hybrid system.
Right.
That actually originated back in the late 1960s, was invented and patented by TRW. They couldn't really put it into production at that time. So those patents from like 1969, 70, 71, And nobody could actually build it because they didn't have the technology at the time in terms of the control systems, the electronic control systems, to make it viable. And it wasn't until the late 90s that you had the electronics and software right. to enable that kind of system to actually function. So most of a lot of what Toyota did was, you know, taking ideas that had already been done somewhere else and now leveraging the capabilities that existed by the late 90s, by the mid to late 90s, to make it, to actually commercialize it.
Exactly.
So Bob, I've got to ask you. So, I mean, one thing that you're sort of alluding to with what you guys did. Okay. So you had 50 cars in the hands of consumers.
Right.
But I mean, there was no infrastructure at all. I mean, you said you had to build the supply base. I mean, so how did you deal with that? I mean, that had to be a real challenge.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we had to put chargers in. I mean, none of that even existed in those days. And then the unfamiliarity of people with electric drive, you know, we had to teach people to drive in some ways. You know, we used to talk about driving like you had an egg under your foot on the accelerator, right? So that you got the most range. Because remember, in those days in the 90s, we were using lead acid batteries. I mean, lithium was still a dream. You know, we went from lead acid to nickel metal hydride and then to lithium. But you did not have that much energy in the battery system.
In fact, Bob, I remember one of the presentations that you guys gave at the time. You had that big, big ass battery pack T-shaped.
Yeah.
And if I remember right, you had a bottle of wine on top of it. And somebody said, I don't know if it was you, that if that bottle of wine was full of gasoline, it had as much energy as in that big battery pack.
Right. No, I remember that. I remember. No, I mean, you know, in terms of just pure energy density, it's hard to beat petroleum-based fuels. I mean, you know, the BTU content of things like gasoline is just off the map compared to anything else.
It's like 33 kilowatt hours of energy, right, in one gallon of gasoline.
Exactly. So, but electric drive, you know, really has its place in the world, and it's particularly becoming true today. You know, like what I'm doing now with VIA, it's all about an application of electric drive to commercial vehicles, to the fleets, because that's where the technology can pay a real benefit. I mean, lower cost of operation and, you know, being respectful of the environment. You know, this is what we're doing now at VIA. We call it V-Trucks. You know, we're starting with a common platform. It's actually built off of a skateboard again, and then a cab chassis vehicle architecture, which we can produce a full range of models with our upfitter partners so that, you know, the customer can really dial in what do they need for their particular routes and things that they're moving. And there's, you know, some pictures of the skateboard, very sophisticated piece of technology, I believe. Is being recognized increasingly as probably the new industry standard for a commercial class skateboard. Very low load floor, flat load floor, 21 inches. So that has some real advantages. Very tight turning circle. So making it, you know, highly maneuverable. But this, you know, you saw the skateboard on the Triax back in 1999. This is where skateboards are today. And this is specifically designed for commercial class vehicles in the class 2 to 5 range. So it's a very flexible architecture and affords us a lot of possibilities in terms of the portfolio of vehicles we can build with it.
So tell us a little bit more about it. You know, you still developing it? Is it production ready? Where do you stand?
We're in the prototype phase now. We go into production in the second half of 2024. We have demonstration vehicles that are out there. You know, this is what it looks like in the flesh. That's a, you know, a fully drivable demonstration vehicle that we've had out in a number of fleets. And we're getting really, really good reviews. We have announced some early orders. We're working with Pegasus. This is going to be used for a new generation of electric school buses. We've got we announced that we're also working with an Australian EV company for right-hand drive version that will be used in Australia for a number of models. And then we're about here to announce here fairly shortly a major customer in Latin America who will be using this vehicle as well. And you can see this is what it looks like as a cab chassis truck without the upfitting on the back, but you can then upfit it with whatever is required for your particular needs.
Where are you going to make them?
Oops, go ahead.
We are working on, we haven't finalized it yet, so I'm not really at liberty to discuss it, but we're going to be partnered with a partner who's very, very capable in the truck manufacturing space that's going to offer us some real advantages in terms of the early manufacturing, because it's an already established operation that we will leverage with our products.
Bob, some people are listening to this on the podcast, yeah, and for them, describe and explain what your skateboard chassis consists of. Why is your skateboard chassis?
Okay, very, very good. The skateboard chassis is basically, you know, a fully integrated chassis system with the drive, you know, integrated in. So your batteries, your motors, your controls and stuff are in the skateboard. So it's a fully functional platform, if you will. You know, that you can then marry with different body configurations. So we'll be, you know, what will be for sale at VIA is both wholly integrated vehicles. So that will have, you know, a cab as well as the upfitting on the back. We're also going to sell just the cab chassis to various upfitters and other partners who want to use that cab chassis with their own configuration on the back, like, for instance, with Pegasus with a school bus body on it. And then we'll also offer skateboards to manufacturers as well who want to use the skateboard for something that that they're developing.
So if somebody buys a skateboard, that's a fully drivable object?
Well, you don't have, you know, the steering and whatever that's, you know, what you would find in the cab. But yes, it's fully functional. I mean, you'd have to have some kind of a seating arrangement or whatever you want to drive it, but it is fully functional, fully tested, fully validated, and then you put the body on in the general assembly area.
And that's really what a lot of the commercial vehicles, the delivery vehicles, the box trucks that you see, they're basically internal combustion skateboards. You know, they buy rolling chassis from Ford or GM or somebody that have an engine, the fuel system, the suspension, brakes and everything. And they put different bodies on top of that.
Exactly right, Sam. The truck industry, particularly, you know, we get into the medium duties. That is the way they've been making vehicles for years. This is now doing it with an electric drive chassis as opposed to a combustion powered chassis. Absolutely right.
You must be excited about the Inflation Reduction Act, right? Because doesn't that $40,000 of incentives apply to your truck?
Yes, it does. Very much so. You know, any vehicles above 14,000 GVWR will be eligible. There is a formula for doing it. It has to do with the cost of the vehicle in the electric drive configuration versus a comparable vehicle in diesel. And so there's some mechanics got to go through. But yes, that $40,000 up to $40,000 incentive will apply to many of the vehicles that VIA will have in production. Very helpful.
How do you what kind of target price are you looking at for the V trucks, you know, compared to a diesel? What kind of price premium do you expect to have when you're in production?
Well, we haven't publicly announced pricing yet, but let's just say it will be sufficient to generate the incentive, you know, where you need like a $30,000 differential.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Bob, you mentioned earlier that one of the advantages is the cost of ownership of a vehicle like this versus traditional. So break it down for us. Why? I mean, everybody says that EVs have a better cost of ownership, but why?
Well, basically, you've got the fuel arbitrage, right? Where if you're looking at driving a vehicle electric versus combustion, you're looking at about 4-to-1, 5-to-1 advantage for driving, you know, electric per mile versus combustion per mile. You also have reduced service needs. You know, you've got permanently sealed motors and things. You don't have engines which require, you know, lubricant changes and the other maintenance that goes along with it. So reduce fuel, reduce maintenance, and that basically drives you into paybacks that are very attractive for the fleets, you know, where you're down into single-digit years to pay back a truck.
VIA was recently in Utah, right? You were based there, and you just moved your headquarters back here. What's going on there?
Yeah, we still have our operation in Utah. It's our R&D center. A lot of people probably don't realize this, but that area of Utah where we're located in Orem, which is down by Provo, that area is second only to Silicon Valley in terms of IT and software companies. I mean, they call it the Silicon Slope. So it's a great place to do advanced technology development, particularly when you're talking about software and control. What we've got now in Michigan, in Auburn Hills, and we're right, those of you who know Auburn Hills, we're right on Harmon. It's the old Magneti Morelli building, if you saw the pictures of it. Great facility, about 98,000 square feet. Half of it is laboratories and build spaces, and then the other half is more set up for office employees. But it's just an absolutely fantastic facility. But it puts us in the heart of the auto industry, you know, where you can really access the talent and the technology and the suppliers just by walking out your front door. And that's what I wanted to do. As you know, John, I've been a long time in and around Detroit. This is the place if you want to start a car company, in my opinion. It's interesting. Some of the people we're attracting are people that originated in Michigan, went out to California, and are now looking to come back to Michigan. So we've got a number of people here from Tesla, as well as some of the other electric vehicle startup companies who are kind of returning home. And it's really exciting. We had good support from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, you know, to help us with this project. So that was very helpful as well.
So Bob, you mentioned software and controls. When people talk about electric vehicles, they're generally talking about batteries. That seems to be the focus. So to what extent are software and controls important or intrinsic to what it is that you guys are doing?
That's a great question, Gary. They're absolutely critical. You know, the way you do the energy balance in the vehicle, you know, managing the energy flows, it's all done through very sophisticated control systems. If you look at the technology in a typical electric drive vehicle around controls, it is actually more sophisticated than what you would even find in some military hardware. I mean, there are high power systems that are very precise in nature. There's sensing of different functions in the vehicle so you can manage the energy properly to get the most efficient use of the energy, because that's what translates into your range, right? We used to say the most important factor here is getting the watts to the road, right? So minimizing your parasitic losses or any loss functions as it involves your electric, that's critical to making it a very useful vehicle, functional vehicle.
What, besides the software, what other aspects of the vehicle or the chassis are being designed in-house at VIA? Are you designing your own purpose-built motors, the battery management system, the power electronics, or are you sourcing a lot of that from various suppliers?
We source most of the components like motors and batteries and so on. However, we're very involved in the design of some of the other technology, particularly in the software and control area. It's our code, if you will. You know, we're not sourcing off the shelf software. So we've got the depth in that area to make that work for us. But we're not getting into the hardware side of it in terms of our own hardware systems.
Okay. Bob, how are you going to elbow your way into the market? You know, you got a bunch of competitors out there, a number of startups. Of course, a former GM exec and his company just went out of business, maybe making a little bit more room for you. But with the other startups getting into commercial and the legacies, especially, you know, eyeing commercial, how are you going to elbow your way into that segment?
Well, that's an equally good question that I get quite a bit. It's a highly competitive market. There's absolutely no question about it. But I believe that VIA has some unique advantages. I think of this as having the experience of an OEM with the creativity of a startup you know, we're, you know, most of us that are in this company have worked at OEMs and tier ones, have done vehicle programs in our past, you know how to do it and know where to avoid the mistakes that some of these less experienced companies can fall into. You know, we've, I think you probably know Bob Lutz is our chairman of the board. And I don't know if you've talked to Bob, but he's still going strong. He's, I admire the guy greatly. He's absolutely with it. And then Don Runkle, who I know that you know, he's on our board. So we've got some guys who have been in the EV space, not quite as long as I have, but almost. And so we've got a great team. The other thing is that I think differentiates us. We listen to the customer and we really try to respond to them in terms of the type of vehicle that they really need for their particular application. We're not trying to sell them a homogenized product. We're trying to sell them a product that they can truly use to their best advantage. So we've worked with a number of the major retailers within their fleets and have done some very extensive voice of the customer work and then incorporated their ideas into our product. And I think that's another place where I think we will excel. And then our skateboard, just in terms of pure technology, I can't get into the specifics of things that are under discussion with various other vehicle manufacturers, but what everyone is attracted to is how can they leverage what we've done with that skateboard for vehicles in their portfolios. In other words, where you'll find that skateboard under other companies' body systems, and they would go to market in that manner. We will be partnered with them. So pretty exciting.
Does the skateboard offer any modularity or flexibility in terms of what somebody can get from
it? We've got it designed to span from class 2 to 5, and it's available in 3 wheelbases, 130, 160, and 190. So we can accommodate a very broad range of vehicle applications. If you look at the cargo area that we have in the van configuration on the lower right, there's a step through van, step in van. You know, we go from 400 to 725 cubic feet of cargo space, payloads anywhere from 3,200 to 9,800 pounds, depending on which model. We've got, you know, again, class 2 to 5. We've got multiple battery configurations that, you know, will span all the way from about 85 miles range up through 250 miles range, depending what you need. So we are essentially one-stop shopping. You'll be able to come to VIA and fill out multiple vehicles that you would need for your portfolio dealing with one partner, VIA Motors. And that's really what it's all about. It's a lot like how an OEM will put product lines together, you know, where you've got core architectures that are able to be expanded to multiple size classes and configurations. We offer front wheel drive in the smaller class vehicles down in the class 2. And then we offer all wheel drive on the class 3 to 5s.
So class 2, are you giving any thought to a pickup truck? I mean, you're right there with a F-250 or Silverado or Ram 2500.
We've given a lot of thought, John, but nothing that I'm going to talk about with you today. But yeah,
for your batteries, what are you using for battery technology?
Well, we're working with a couple. It's all highly proprietary, but we're working with two of the big battery manufacturers, and we're trying to put together some schemes that'll work for both of us. You know, being a relatively small company by volume, we don't have, you know, the volume leverage that the big guys have, and you can see what's being spent in batteries today. I mean, hardly a week goes by that you don't see a multi-billion-dollar investment in battery plants that are going to be going into the United States. So, you know, we're going to be more picking up around those rather than having the resources to go build one of those plants. But I think we're doing fairly well. Hopefully, we'll be able to make some more definitive announcements here in fairly short order.
Are you using nickel-rich chemistries or LFP or something else?
No, we're basically looking at both the NMC and the LFP, depending on which manufacturer you talk about. There's some advantages to each, depending on your configurations.
Hey, look, we got to take a quick commercial break. Give a shout out to Bridgestone and BorgWarner, the companies that make this show possible. Okay. And then we want to pick your brain. I mean, there's so much to talk about with what's going on the electric side of the industry. We'll get into that. But right now, let's take that quick break.
How do Bridgestone tires stop shorter on wet roads? It's their HydroTrack technology. But you don't have to know how the science works, just where the brake is. What really matters is their Bridgestone.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry.
All right, we're talking with Bob Purcell here from VIA Motors. But Bob, one of the last times you were on the show, you were with Protean doing hub motors. Where does that all stand right now? You don't have hub motors on this truck at VIA, do you?
No, we don't. We're actually using what are called 3-in-1 and 2-in-1 drive systems, you know, where you've got integral differential motor and power electronics. I still stay in contact with my friends at Protean. They've been actually in the last few years, they've been sold a couple of times. They're still going strong. I still believe in the right applications, a hub motor can make sense, but we're not there today with VIA.
Well, what's holding it back? You know, the only automaker I'm aware of that's using them is Lordstown Motors and the Endurance pickup. What's holding back hub motors?
Well, I think cost is probably still an issue. You know, it's and there's still people who believe that we shouldn't have mass out on the end of an axle after we spent all these years trying to get it off the end of the axle. So you still got to make believers out of them. And then just some basic stuff around sealing technology and, you know, making sure it'll meet all the durability requirements. But we had some really good experiences with those hub motors. You know, we did some concept vehicles with Daimler. Both a hybrid as well as an electric drive. And we had it at the Frankfurt Auto Show back in, was that 2011? And won some really significant technology awards. But it's, I guess for some customers, it's just too much of a shift to be driving at the ends of the axle.
One of the concerns I've always had around hub motors is obviously, you know, the unsprung mass. But when you put the motor in the wheel, now you have to run your high voltage wires from the battery to the motor in a way, you know, that wire is going to be flexing up and down as the wheel moves up and down. And as anybody who's ever, you know, played with a paperclip for a few minutes knows, you know, wires don't like to bend back and forth. And how do you overcome that problem?
I'm not sure where they ended up, so I'm going to be a little bit dated. I mean, it's been quite a few years since I've worked with hub motors. But I remember back in my days, they were looking at different types of wire configurations as well as these flex tubes that went over the wiring, okay, that would reduce the bend, you know, keep the bend radius at the right level so that you didn't stress the copper. But I'm not sure where they ultimately ended up. I haven't kept track of it.
Bob, you started your journey in electric vehicles with passenger cars, okay? Individuals would own one, buy one. Now you're in a space of commercial vehicles. Mm-hmm. Is this because, you know, to go back to the quote I read earlier from you about the technical feasibility and the commercial viability, is this where we are at right now, that commercial is really the sweet spot for EVs?
I believe it is, Gary, and I actually believe this even back in my EV1 days. That's why I really pushed hard on doing that S10. And then when I was at Protean, you know, with the wheel motors, we were working with Vauxhall with their vans. But I think the electric drive is just a good fit particularly where you're talking shorter range, lower speed operation of the vehicle. You know, it's a, essentially a rechargeable appliance that you drive. And I, you know, you can make a good economic business case to the fleet. You know, some of the things we talked about earlier with the difference in the cost of fuel per mile, the reduced maintenance that's required. It's just good economics. You've got good payback on these trucks, while at the same time doing something good for highly congested environments, you know, the cities and the suburban regions where you've got a lot of people. And the idea of taking, you know, combustion tailpipes out of the fleets in those cities is good for everybody. So that's kind of the way I look at it. It's an optimal solution in the commercial space, particularly as it relates to last mile, mid mile delivery vehicles.
What's your sense of how the whole EV thing is going to go, at least in the U.S. to begin with on the discussion? You know, everyone's scrambling to get the battery plants that you talked about. There's a big scramble to get the raw materials to do it. The charging infrastructure still needs to be built up. There's, of course, now EVs have become politicized as well. Right. How's it all going to shake out? Take us to 2030. Where do you think we're going to be?
I think it's going to catch on in the commercial space. I think it's going to become the de facto solution, particularly for the last mile, mid mile type deliveries. I think there's going to be a high percentage of those vehicles that will be electric drive, because again, it's very economically efficient for the operator, you know, for the fleet operator, but it's also very good for the environment. So you kind of serve, you know, two purposes with one class of technology. What's going on in the passenger car space? You know, there's a lot of good work. I mean, the level of investment going on is unparalleled. I mean, virtually every major OEM is talking about spending what 30 to 40 billion in the electric drive space over the next several years. That's unprecedented. I keep reminding my guys here, you know, this is unparalleled in the industry. Talking about, you know, migrating to a different fundamental propulsion technology in an industry of this size, you know, the last time electric drive was really vying for a space, you know, a true space in the automotive industry was back at the start of the industry. I mean, John, you know, you've heard this many times. I mean, number one in 1900 was steam. Okay, number two was electric, and number three was internal combustion. And then when you got to the more efficient ways of cracking gasoline from petroleum, and then, you know, the distribution, it became, you know, commonplace that internal combustion was going to win out. But we're back there now. Okay, 120 years later, we're back where people are honestly going to give electric drive passenger cars a try. But it's going to look, the industry, I think, in the passenger car space is going to look like it did in the early days of the internal combustion space. You know, there were well over 100 car companies, in the early days of the combustion era of automotive, and it shook out to what, 5 or 6 major players. And I think that's about the way it's going to go in this space as well. You know, there's some of them out there that will probably be the 21st century equivalent of Packard, right? Some very creative solutions, you know, but for a number of reasons didn't have the longevity, didn't get the scale.
Hey, Bob, you know, Ford is shipping e-transits now. GM's got their BrightDrop vans. Yep. There's other competitors to what you're doing, like Arrival and assorted others out there. How do you, what's your story for why VIA should be one of those 5 or 6 survivors rather than the other 100 that didn't make it?
Because I think we're going to have one of the best engineered products in the marketplace. And because of the talent of the people that we have here who have the experience base. And I think we're also going to be able to offer our new partnership that's yet to happen here, but it's well underway. We're going to be able to offer financing packages and charging along with the vehicle in an integrated package that is going to make it easier for people to make the shift to electric drive. I'm talking the fleets now. And I think that's going to be a differential advantage for us. But the proof is in the pudding. I can't tell you how many people we've had driving these demo and prototype vehicles that we've got running around right now that the comments they've made are, this is like an OEM developed product. And I said, yeah, that's true, because a lot of the people working on it, that's where we came from. And we know how to do it right. We're not out there trying to make something work. We're out there doing it right. I think one of the real compliments, as you can see this is Work Truck Magazine. The September issue, we were the cover of the September issue, and I really like it. Work Truck Via Delivers. That's, we're designing vehicles that can really be used in fleets, that can do the miles and do the years and give people the good service at a very attractive price. So that's the way I think you build a business. These big competitors, what we're finding, they're getting some early sales because they're the first ones out there, and I applaud them for everything they've done to be able to do that. But they're not so much willing to change what they have to accommodate the customer's needs. They're selling the product that they've designed. And so we're kind of coming at it from the other dimension. What do you need? How can we tailor our vehicle to best meet your drive cycles and your route requirements?
So by doing that though, Bob, I mean, aren't you putting yourself at an economic disadvantage, because they would basically say, hey, we've got scale, and they're basically building, several one-offs.
They've got scale. We've got modularity. If we have the right partnerships with the suppliers, which I feel we're doing quite well at, I think we'll be able, you're right. I mean, scale amounts to a lot in automotive. There's absolutely no question about it. But I think we're going to be able to offer a good value proposition, all things considered. They're going to get the truck they really want. And they're going to be willing, hopefully to reward us for doing that. And we're, I don't have aspirations that we're going to grow into the next General Motors. I just want to be profitable at a very, measured volume level. Okay. So our business model is not, we have to sell 500,000 to make money. Right. Ours is, like a tenth of that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, and that's the way we're scaling it. This is why we're going to work with a partner, for instance, on the assembly side, because it's going to save us a tremendous amount of capital and will allow us to have a much lower break-even point.
But even with that, you got to raise a lot of money. How you going to do, the SPAC thing seems to have run its course. I don't know. Are you thinking of that, or how are you going to get the money you need?
Well, you've probably read we're entering into a merger with a company called Ideanomics. They're a holding company structure. It's all focused around electric drive. Their mission is to help the fleets to make the transition to electric drive cost effectively. And what they offer, they're going to be offering vehicle financing, as well as they've got other companies in their portfolio that are focused on charging system, both wireless charging as well as, more conventional conductive charging. And so we'll be able to offer a total package with them. And also be able to offer financing that will make it, they can basically end up in a situation where they're leasing everything. Okay, so that offers a business advantage, particularly to a fleet. Mm-hmm. So,
speaking of charging, one of the areas that's growing in interest, especially for commercial customers and particularly in areas like school buses, electric school buses, it's bidirectional charging, vehicle to grid capability or vehicle to load capability. Is that something that you've incorporated into your chassis to have that bidirectional capability?
We have worked on, we've already worked on programs with the military, both the United States Air Force and the Marine Corps out at Miramar for bidirectional charging capability, where they backfeed the grid with their vehicles on base. And so, yeah, we do have some depth in that area. And then the other you know, interesting charging technology that's starting to getting a lot of attention is at Ideanomics. They have a company called Wave, and Wave is, you know, wireless charging, inductive charging. And you've probably seen some of the announcements with Wave with various fleets. Interesting. I mean, we had, you know, the EV1 was an inductive couple, right? It was not a conductive paddle. It was an inductive system. And we actually had wireless charging actually embedded in the road service in Torrance, California. And there was a bus fleet that was running inductive charging. This would have been 1998, 1999. So it's been around for a while, but it's become much more refined and cost effective now. So that's, you know, what I see happening in charging. The issue with charging, particularly as you get into the very high powered systems, is battery life. I mean, you're hitting the battery really hard to put it back in. Now, there's a lot of great work that's been done. I think a lot of the challenges, you know, have been solved. But that's always going to be an issue, is whether you're going to trade off life with the rate of charge.
So, Bob, what do you think about battery swapping? You know, China's really pushing hard on that. And it would seem to me that from a commercial standpoint, where vehicles are going back to the same yard all the time, that might be pretty easy to do. What do you think about swapping?
I think it's got some potential. I was familiar with that approach back when I was working with one of the advanced battery companies. They were supplying battery systems to the buses in China. And I remember, you know, the battery swapping technology. It was very, very well thought out. I mean, the operator didn't really have to do anything. I mean, you pulled in and everything was done automatically. So I think that may have some potential. I do.
It seems to me that, you know, the public is so worried about not just range anxiety, but charge time anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems to me that if you can make it work financially and all that, and I'm not sure that that can be done without heavy government subsidies, but nonetheless, if you could get swapping to work, boom, range anxiety and charge time anxiety goes out the window.
Okay, Bob, but I got to ask you, though. I mean, so aren't many EVs being engineered such that the battery becomes a structural part of the whole system, and therefore taking it out is not even possible?
Yes, I think it's going to be more in the larger class commercial vehicles. And you'd have to design the vehicle up front to be able to swap out batteries. You're absolutely right, Gary. Like, our battery pack in that skateboard is a structural element as well as an energy storage system. And that's also true in many of the products. Teslas are like that as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Although, you know, in a commercial vehicle application, you know, where, you know, and a lot of fleets, you know, have relatively homogeneous fleets. I think to what John was saying earlier, you know, about standardizing, you know, you will have a standardized battery pack format. And, you know, for commercial vehicles, in a lot of use cases, you want to minimize downtime, maximize the utilization. So swapping might be a good solution for any of those use cases, because you've got the same kind of batteries. And a fleet, you know, you don't have the problem of, you know, a customer coming in, they don't know what the condition of the battery they're getting in when they do a swap, you know, if it's any good or not. But a fleet, you know, you know the provenance of all those batteries. So I think I've always thought it was a lot more viable concept for commercial customers than for consumers.
I would agree with you, Sam. I think it's a very good point. Very good point.
But again, Bob, would this mean that when someone, whether it's VIA or another company, is developing these vehicles, I mean, from the get-go, they've got to say, okay, all of the connections are going to be the same. This thing is going to be, you know, so, you know, it's like printers, right? I mean, you need the right cartridge all the time. And
no, that's right. No, standardizing the system is the key to those types of process. I mean, it's real easy with, internal combustion, right? It's the diameter of the inlet on the fuel tank. It's not too tough, but on an electric drive system, it's a lot more complex than that. But standardization is going to be absolutely essential. Yep.
Totally. So as long as you guys are looking at inductive charging, What are your thoughts of powered roadways? You think that's going to go anywhere? You know, whereas you drive down the road, you're picking up some juice so that as your vehicle enters the powered roadway, the state of charge of the battery is going to be the same as at the end of the powered roadway because you're just picking up juice as you drive along.
Well, I don't know, John. I don't know how old you are, but I don't know if you remember the old streetcar systems. It was actually powered roadways overhead.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So maybe we go back there, only this time inductively, and it's in the road surface rather than over the road.
Do you think it's a viable concept?
It's a possible concept, I'll say that. Yeah. But there you're going to get into the infrastructure of actual roads themselves and embedding, you know, the technology into the road surface and all that. And it's possible, but it's probably a ways off in my opinion. There may be some routes, I don't know, where, you know, heavily traveled routes with commercial vehicles where maybe you could do that, certain roadways. But I don't think it would be a widespread solution, at least not. You know, it'll take a period of decades probably to get there, realistically.
Bob, I want to ask you an experiential question. Okay, you've worked for one of the largest corporations in the world, and you've worked for small startup companies. Tell us about the culture of these two different types of organizations from the standpoint of product development.
That is a great question. Actually, Gary, you know, I started in the small business end of the industry. I mean, you know, I went to a technical high school. It also had college prep, but I was apprenticed at 15. Hmm. Okay. I was certified powertrain and electrical at 18. I was a service manager at 19. And then until I was 30 years old, I didn't work for a company that had over 30 people. Hmm. Okay, I worked in car dealerships, independent garages. I was involved with racing both lower class formula cars, and then we also built and raced unlimited class motorcycles. So that's how I grew up, you know, family owned type businesses where everybody knew each other and whatever. So I brought that with me to General Motors, but I came to General Motors at 30. And I had, you know, some of my time, I worked on exotics. I see Maserati and stuff, Sam, there on your wall back there, it looks like. That's at 18 years old, I was working on Maserati, Ferrari, Lamborghini, Aston Martin, Jaguar. We had an exotic shop and, you know, some really advanced technology. I mean, I was certified on electronic fuel injection, 1971. Okay, most people wouldn't even know what it was if they ever saw it. So I've had the good fortune of being able to work on some of the most advanced technology in the industry through my whole career because of the class of vehicles. Culturally, within General Motors, there were many companies. I know there was the big, you know, mothership GM, but really you could find very distinct differences between the different operating divisions. I had the good fortune, you know, I started in General Motors at Pontiac Motor Division with one of the people I still admire to this day, God rest his soul, he's passed on, but Bill Hoagland, mm-hmm. you know, was, and John, I know you know Bill well, he was a very unique individual. I mean, he really cared about the customer, he really cared about the people that worked for him, and just was very hands-on in terms of how he approached the business. And I just really loved it. So within GM, there were different groups. Like my advanced technology vehicle group, when I was doing, you know, the electrics and the hybrids, you know, it was like a family business. So I kind of carried that mentality about the culture through my whole career. And now here at V, it's the same type of a feel. We're more like a family business than a corporation. And like I say, even in my GM days, I tended to gravitate to those. I was never like in one of the big platforms. I was always doing, you know, advanced products and stuff. So that's kind of my forte. But we put a lot of time and attention into what kind of a culture are we trying to create. And like I said before, we've got a number of people here from Tesla And some of them work directly with Elon Musk. I mean, one of my guys here who's in the homologation, actually leads the homologation group, he was employee number 32 at Tesla. So he was there when Tesla was, you know, 30 guys in a little, you know, building. Nobody even knew what Tesla was at that point in time, trying to figure out how to make it work. But I think I had the good fortune of working for a couple of years with Dr. Deming. And Dr. Deming said something to me that has stuck with me for all these years. He says, joy in work. Joy in work derives from an individual understanding how what they do day in and day out directly contributes to the success of the company. And that's the key. Everybody's got to feel like and know that they make a difference and it's recognized. And that's that to me is the key to having a successful culture.
That's a great point. And that's why Dr. Deming is still studied today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the big prize in Japan is the Deming Award. I mean, that, yeah, he was a very, very unique. I think about that guy sometimes. He was born in the year 1900 and then lived to be, 90 years old. So what he saw in his 90-year lifetime, I mean, he literally went from horse and buggy to landing on the moon, within his lifespan. And he was a character. I mean, he was really a very, very interesting man to talk to and work with. But that's what I've carried with me. Make sure everyone is recognized for what they do, and what they do is meaningful to the success of the business, and that you as the leader recognize that.
And, you know, that's probably a good point to wrap up this whole discussion on that point. Bob Purcell, thanks so much for coming on. It's great to have you back on the show. Good luck with Viad. I think the truck looks really cool myself.
And, yeah, thank you.
I think you'll find a place in the market. And Sam, thank you for coming on, too. It's always good to have you on here, you know, especially somebody with an engineering background like you've got and an analyst mindset to go along with it. It's fantastic.
Well, thanks for inviting me today, John. It's always good to be on with you guys.
And Gary, you and I will just keep on doing it.
You know, next week. Okay. Bob, good seeing you again. Sam,
good seeing you.
Nice to meet you, Bob.
All right, everybody. Take care, Sam.
All right, see ya.
Right, bye. AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, solutions for your journey, and by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
If you like this program and would like to learn more about the automotive industry, check out our website at autoline.tv or look for us on YouTube on the Autoline channel.